Good morning. The Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee will come to order. The first item of business we have is the approval of our last meeting's minutes. I see that Representative Cal Barr is raising his hand. Representative Barr, after a thorough examination of last meeting's minutes, would you move those minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from our last meeting.
And Representative Barr puts forth the motion to approve the minutes. All those in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. A technical item here. Do we have quorum? We don't. We're going to have to wait. All right, we'll come back to the minutes. And that was a warm-up, folks. It's Monday morning. Everyone's got to be a little graceful today. I see that Representative Miller is here. Representative Miller, the chair will move House File 1495. I believe your intention is for it to go to taxes.
Yes, sir.
With that, the chair moves that House File 1495, upon passage of this committee, would go to taxes. Representative Miller, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for hearing this bill. My comments will be brief and to the point to this committee. I will not get too much into detail on tax issues unless I'm asked. I will discuss those further in detail in the tax committee should this be referred. I do have a few. I have one testifier, actually, who will speak to the technical aspects of the bill and the importance of it. Members, corn-produced ethanol has developed into perhaps the greatest value-add product for sure in agriculture, and perhaps even for any raw materials grown or mined here in Minnesota. It has stabilized and improved this important commodity market. It has created thousands of new good-paying jobs for rural Minnesota. The very nature of the ethanol industry is a testament to the possibilities of renewable, clean energy, but the industry has taken even further steps in their production practices to be efficient and clean in energy use. Many of the ethanol plants in Minnesota have either achieved or are in the process of achieving minimal use of groundwater and zero discharge into our waterways. Beyond the ethanol production, they also produce oils used in many other industries. They produce high-value feed through DDGs. Despite the industry's success and high standards, they continue to strive to do better. One such area is in the reuse of thermal energy. The distillation of corn into ethanol requires and produces a great deal of heat. With new technologies, they're able to capture and reuse this thermal energy. However, this technology is cost prohibitive to install. My bill today is a way to incentivize the installation of these technologies through tax credits. My bill, if it becomes law, will provide a tax credit of 50% of the cost for up to 10 years after installation. These credits cannot go beyond reducing a tax liability. Unused credits are rolled into subsequent years until used up to 10 years, and these credits can only be used for plants here in Minnesota. Right now, Mr. Chair, I would like my testifier to speak, and we can answer any questions after that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Timothy Rudnicki, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. We're delighted to be here and very grateful that Representative Miller has put together House File 1495, and I just want to give you a few reasons why we speak in favor of and support the bill. And perhaps this is an example of where a picture is worth more than a thousand words. It's my understanding in your information packet there should be a couple of documents. One has an image of something called, it's actually captioned, examples of CHP and EG systems. If you look closely at that photo, you'll see to the right what looks like the base of a rocket motor. And actually, that's a part of a jet engine. And this is an example of a technology that we believe has great potential in the renewable biofuels and the renewable chemicals industry, because this is a device that allows for the generation of heat, which is used in the production process that Representative Miller spoke of, and it also generates electricity. One other benefit to the system is not only does it provide the electricity and heat needed in the process, but it eliminates line loss, which is associated with transmitting electricity over long distances from the generating center to the actual use. And on the back of the photo sheet, you'll see another device. It's called an expander generator. Now, we think this also has great potential in the renewable ethanol industry as well as renewable chemicals industry because it's a device that takes high pressure and converts, whether it's steam or gas or fluids from high to low pressure, it takes that pressure difference and actually converts it into electricity. So in addition to those types of environmental benefits, it could lower the carbon footprint even further for renewable chemicals and for renewable biofuels. Plus, there's a significant opportunity here to create essentially a new industry. Many years ago, there were incentives provided for energy conservation throughout the state, whether it was homes or businesses. And here's an opportunity to actually launch a new industry that could provide jobs in design, manufacture, installation, and maintenance. So once again, because of all those social, economic, and environmental benefits, we speak in support of House File 1495.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Just looking at this picture you handed out, the gentleman in the lower right corner here, it kind of looks like Representative Miller leaning into that jet engine, and kind of looks like he's got a cigarette in his mouth. I don't know.
Is there any carbon footprint on this car?
Members, any questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller, I just read this quickly. I did not see a limit on, or two limits that we usually put in bills. One is on how much an individual project can get. It just says 50%, but is it 50% of any amount?
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I hope I can answer it this way, because you're correct in that. The limit is put on the level of tax credits at that 50% up to 10 years. So while that may not limit if they never achieve that 50% over 10 years, how much that may be true, but they can only do up to 50% over a 10-year period of time. What that specific dollar amount is, I don't know that I can answer that if Mr. Rudnicki would be able to answer that or anyone else would be.
Mr. Rudnicki.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Wagenius, it's my understanding the expander generators could cost as much as $250,000, and combined heat and power units could cost several million dollars, depending on the actual capacity of thermal energy and electricity they're able to provide.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, and perhaps Representative Wagenius, this may help as well. When we had our meetings, I asked what the revenue note on this is, and we're going to be putting that together for the tax committee. The estimated revenue note will be roughly about, we don't have this yet, but we're estimating it to be about $350,000 a year, up to $350,000 a year.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. So the other thing we often put in bills like this is a maximum that maximum tax expenditure.
Right.
Is your maximum tax expenditure going to be what?
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think that's a valid question, and I think that's something as we move this on, should it be referred to the tax committee, we'll have that prepared in advance so that we can answer that question for the tax committee.
Representative Wagenius.
Just a final question. I note that this is retroactive. That feels a bit unusual to me since we're encouraging the people to do things in the future and we're asking for this money to encourage a certain behavior, yet it's retroactive to last December. Help me understand that.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, this is anything that's installed after December 31st, 2015, so you're correct that it's a 2016 year. That's included with that. It's my understanding, and I'll let Mr. Rudnicki explain a little bit further, but it's my understanding that some of this technology is in the process right now, correct?
Mr. Rudnicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, that's my understanding. There may be a site where this is in process, and I believe that would coincide with the last tax cycle.
Right.
Members, let me take a second to interject here quickly. We now have a quorum. All those in favor of approving the minutes as presented indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries or approved. Representative Wagenius, do you have any other questions? No? All right, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, correct me, I'm going to try and pronounce your name, Rudnicki?
Rudnicki.
Rudnicki. Mr. Rudnicki, what part of a cogen is this tax credit going to affect? The whole kit and caboodle, or just the jet engine?
Mr. Rudnicki.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, it's my understanding it's the entire system. So the jet engine actually is providing the thermal energy, but it has a shaft that spins like a jet engine, so that would also spin a generator. So my understanding of the language in the bill is it would be that entire system as opposed to one part.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. And I do have a series of questions here because I'm going to back up a little bit. Representative Miller, who do you alluded to that this is primarily for biofuels plants, ethanol and the bio, the other one, I can't remember which one, what they call it. Do you envision this being in a number of different places, different industries, different places?
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, there is potential for this to be in other industries that would use this type of equipment. So, for example, the sugar beet industry. Man, any industry in agriculture that produces a lot of thermal energy is where there's potential for this to be. Right now, what you will find is that the ethanol plants in Minnesota tend to be the industry leaders on this sort of technology, really driving down the carbon footprint, really trying to reuse energy as much as possible, be as efficient as possible. So you're seeing this primarily in the ethanol industry at this time, but is it applicable and potential in other industries? Most certainly, and I would actually encourage those other industries to look into this. Would you? I know that we talked about this, Mr. Rudnicki, if you'd like to expand on my answer at all.
Mr. Rudnicki.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct, the way it was framed. What's critical, I think, first of all, in Minnesota, based on a recent ABF economic study, about 18,000 jobs are supported by the renewable ethanol industry. What's key here is that the industry itself has been striving for efficiencies. As Representative Miller pointed out, many plants, if not all by now, are zero liquid discharge. Reuse of water, bringing a water usage down far below what's used to produce any gasoline. In some plants, we're talking about less than 2 gallons of water per 1 gallon out, and then there's the reuse factor. The carbon index is very critical because actually there's an internationally accepted GREET model, which has been expounded by the Argonne National Laboratory. And what's critical for that analysis is looking at upstream and downstream energy inputs. So anything that can be done in the agricultural sector to create efficiencies, anything that can be done at the plant to create efficiencies, such as would be done by an expander generator or a combined heat and power unit, improves that score. And that means for any of us who at this point still drive a spark ignition engine vehicle, if we use the ethanol, we actually are driving with a lower carbon fuel. So there are multiple benefits on a societal level and for an environmental analysis as well.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I don't mean to be rude, but I really just want to know what other industries you are thinking of here, because I know oil refineries love this. They love this. And I know there's at least one, if not a second one, that's looking at putting in a cogen operation. Almost any large processing plant has excess capacity that goes out the smokestack. What homework have you done to tell me, to tell this committee, how you're going to affect the jobs in those other industries? How are you going to affect the other jobs and profitability of our utilities, which, for better or worse, this will put a lot of power onto the grid. So my question there would be, you might have some homework to do there. Will the grid accept it? Is it ready for it? And how is it going to affect all the pensioners that have invested in their co-ops and utilities and everything else? So what I'm asking is are you limiting this to just ethanol plants, or are you opening up a can of worms without looking beyond the immediate can?
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't know if this is a can of worms. I think this is a can of opportunity. So you look at this as a negative, and I see it as a positive. So certainly there are other industries, as we said, this could expand use into. Is our focus right now on the ethanol plants? Yes, because as I said, the ethanol plants are in a position to be able to do just the nature of how they do their business. This is a very coherent, very complete system that's going to work there. But there are certainly other industries that can look into this. Now, if you would say that where the unexpected outcomes could come from is perhaps what Representative Wagenius was referring to, is there a cap on the taxes? That's why I can certainly talk to the tax committee so that we don't open the door to suddenly we're flooding in with an unexpected amount. This is very technical, very expensive stuff. The ethanol industry is poised and ready to do this sort of thing. I don't know that all other industries are or even interested at this time, but certainly they can be in the future. And certainly when you hear tax credits, that sometimes is an incentive to perhaps say we want to look at it. So I'm going to let perhaps he can further clarify as to what I'm talking about, Mr. Finicky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, you raised what I understood to be an interconnection grid issue, and the bill has a specific cap on the nameplate capacity for combined heat and power systems as well as for the expander generators. So I can't speak for other industries, but I believe in the renewable biofuel space and the renewable chemical space, this is not about going off the grid. So in other words, it's a supplement, and it may displace some amount of electricity on the grid, but it's still, the plants would still be on the grid. So this is not a standalone system we're talking about here. And with respect to, again, the renewable biofuel and renewable chemical industry that I'm familiar with, I'm not aware of any intent to somehow become a producer and begin a power purchase agreement. So my understanding is the caps on the capacity prevent that from happening in the first place.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so that Representative Miller and Mr. Reneke understand, I've helped or worked on three new cogeneration plants, and as a retired pipe fitter, I might get to go work on the ones at Koch Industries that are putting up here in the next year. Which would be eligible under your bill. And they've been planning this for years without any kind of tax break whatsoever, but now you've just given them a multi-million dollar tax break, it looks like. And I don't know what they're calling the other refinery down in St. Paul Park, but with this, they're going to be looking at that. I can name a couple of other industries that are right on the cusp of just a little bit of incentive, they're much more likely to look at that. So I don't think you've done your homework on how this bill is going to work itself out, but that's in the tax committee. But for Mr. Reneke's answer to my part of my question is, so none of this energy that is created by these cogeneration plants would go back onto the grid and affect the co-ops or the munis or the investor-owned utilities. Now, I'm being very, very clear. So from your answer, what I took was that none of this energy goes back onto the grid, and it would only be used at the point of source, because otherwise then you probably should have the co-ops and the munis and the investor-owned utilities down here telling us what they think of this particular bill.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's my understanding, that the, in fact, there's an in-process example of this where it's my understanding the buyer of the electricity either has or will be in negotiations with the utility, and there is an understanding that there will be this availability of electricity from the grid, and the CHP or expander generators is only providing a small portion relative to the total amount of energy for that site. So that's my understanding.
Representative Miller, do you have any other invited testifiers? Before I go back to Representative Mahoney, do you have any other invited testifiers? Okay, so Representative Mahoney.
So there's your understanding. So this actually could be selling energy back to the grid, subject to negotiation, until we get cranky at the legislature here and force the utility to buy that power from you, and we'll probably set the price on it too, because that's how we operate here. And then the next question, something you should think about, is we just changed the way that residential customers get charged for having, well, it's net neutrality. Is it net neutrality or?
Net metering.
Net metering, thank you. So are we going to give the ability to those utilities, or those power co-ops, munis, and investor-owned, are we going to give them the ability, the same ability to charge these plants back for their net neutrality? So there's a lot of questions here. See where it goes. That's not a question. That's just a comment at the end of the bill.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to additional members and questions and comments. Seeing none, Representative Miller, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for hearing this. I Representative Wagini, so I think you make a good point. And Representative Mahoney, I will look into that, but I'm confident that we are not moving in that direction of selling back energy. This is a way to reduce the footprint of those actual plants. So we'll certainly, if that's an unintended consequence, we'll deal with that. I don't anticipate that being a problem, but thank you for your time, and I ask for your support.
With that, Representative Neuberger renews his motion to have House File 1495 recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. No. Motion prevails. We're on our way to taxes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Or you're on your way to taxes. I'm not. So, Representative Albright. Morning, Representative Albright.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
The Chair moves that House File 1950 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Albright, do you have any amendments to your bill?
I do not.
All right, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1950 is the grant program established to award grants to eligible applicants. And the purpose for being here before you this morning is in order to match those funds received through the Federal Small Business and Innovation Research and Small Business Technology Transfer Programs, we need to enact language to fulfill that matching contribution. I have two testifiers with me this morning, Mr. Chair, John Dukich and Pat Dillon, who I might add is a commander of the United States Navy for 31 years, so she will be steering the ship, if it were. So with that, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Pat Dillon. Okay. So this is my first time, Mr. Chairman, committee members. It's been a long time. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. So thank you, Representative Albright, for being here today and representing this bill. This is a very important program, not only in the United States, but it certainly is in the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota High Tech, is it this one? This one. Okay. So the Minnesota High Tech Association represents more than 300 science and technology companies and organizations throughout Minnesota with the goal of helping Minnesota become a top five science and technology state. We are making progress toward that goal, and the 2016 Milken Institute Science and Technology Index ranked Minnesota 7th nationally, up from 12th in 2014. We get high rankings for our science and technology workforce, but we still have a lot of work to do when it comes to investments in R&D inputs, where Minnesota ranks 19th. The top four of the top five states in the Milken Science and Technology Index report are in the top five with respect to R&D inputs. The fifth-ranked state, Washington, is ranked seventh in R&D inputs. Again, Minnesota is ranked seventh overall, however, is ranked 19th in R&D inputs. One measure of R&D inputs includes public and private investment in research and development. There are two critical federal R&D programs that support public and private investment in small businesses, the Federal Small Business Innovation Research Program and the Small Business Technology Transfer Program. Combined, these programs represent about $2.5 billion each year, each fiscal year, to fund high-risk, high-payoff research and development with the whole goal of commercializing the technology. SBIR and STTR funds game-changing, disruptive, cutting-edge science and technology with the potential for commercialization. These programs are highly competitive programs that support not only startups but also existing U.S.-based companies to conduct early-stage research and development in order to produce proprietary new products and services for economic gain. These programs seek to transform scientific discovery into societal and economic benefit by catalyzing private sector commercialization of these innovations. These programs increase the incentive and the opportunity for startups and small businesses to really undertake this cutting-edge R&D, which would probably not happen otherwise. There are 11 federal agencies that provide these investments in two different phases. And the first phase is basically a proof-of-concept phase where the company can compete for up to $225,000 to support that technology feasibility work that they need to do. The second phase can be up to $1.5 million in some cases. So over a period of 2.5-3 years, a small business could receive this non-dilutive R&D funding to support research that is aimed at commercializing a technology for a new product or service. And some federal agencies offer follow-on funding beyond the second phase. You can think of the SBIR and STTR grants or contracts as angel funding, except that it is non-dilutive and it's federally funded. The company retains the worldwide rights to the intellectual property. And by increasing the incentive and the opportunity for these small firms to undertake this high-risk, high-payoff research, the whole goal is to transform that into benefits to our society. Since 1982 and 1992, more than $550 million has been funded to small companies in Minnesota, from Winona to Rochester to Duluth, and certainly here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the surrounding suburbs. These programs support industry and academic research, advancement in science and technology that results in patentable technology, licensing of University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic technologies for commercialization, and research and strategic partnerships with large and small companies. It also brings in angel and venture capital investments, and it supports our highly trained STEM workforce in many areas of scientific disciplines important to Minnesota's economy. SBIR and STTR funding has led to several companies to go from the garage startup phase to a publicly held firm, several firms to be acquired or merged with other organizations, and many others go out and raise additional capital to support what they're doing. And some just decide to bootstrap their firms and become local small businesses in our communities. SBIR, STTR funding occurs in many of our technology sectors, including medical, device, biotech, defense, aerospace, energy, agriculture, information technology, cybersecurity, nanotechnology, and much more. By providing state matching funds to these companies that receive this funding, it will help those companies take that federal funding further and encourage our other companies to take advantage of these programs. We'd like to see more federal research dollars come to Minnesota. Because if it's not coming to Minnesota, it's going to some other state. And a matching grant program is one way to help encourage our companies to take advantage of this funding and help foster a thriving science and technology industry in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Or do you not have testimony?
I have testimony, Mr. Chair.
We should still say your name anyways.
John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association, and here to answer any questions.
Any questions? What's your favorite professional sports team?
I have to say the Minnesota Vikings, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Dukic, what's your position on the designated hitter?
Mr. Chair, not good.
This is a public hearing. He's right. He's got the right position. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close public comment. Move to member questions or comments from the committee. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the chair yield for a question? Can we afford this? Do we have targets yet? Is this committee going to authorize to spend this money? Where are we going with the financial end of this?
Well, first of all, you don't have to ask me to yield to a question. We're in committee. You can just ask me a question, Representative Sundin. But
I was going to comment about something else, but I passed.
Yeah. So, Representative Sundin, as I think you're aware, we do not have targets yet. I would expect that given the very early deadlines, we would have those targets by the middle of next week. Certainly, the resources that are made available to this committee by the Ways and Means Committee would determine our flexibility to determine appropriations for this bill or any other bill we're considering. So, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is just going to be added to the wish list.
Representative Sundin, that's every session. There's lots of wishes and lots of lists.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm clear on that now.
Yep. Any other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple. The first is, do we know what the proposed federal budget is doing with this program? I'm an author. I think it's a great idea, but I just was curious about that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen. Currently, with the congressional budgets, some of them are still under review, and so there's been no final dollar amount, but we're projecting it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.5 billion, as it has been for the last number of years.
Okay. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And then just on the 550 companies you mentioned, do we know how many of those have actually taken an idea to have commercialized an idea, what the economic impact of that has been, and how much private funding has been leveraged as a result of in those cases?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, so it's not 550 companies. It's about 150 companies or more than 150 companies since 1982 that have been successful in winning this funding. It's been about $550 million, but, those numbers are coming in as the fiscal year closes and the agencies report their final awards. Excuse me, sir, but what was the next question?
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 150 companies that got this grant, do we know how many have actually successfully taken a product to market? And then how much that the money that came in the federal grants was leveraged with private dollars? How many private dollars were leveraged, I guess?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, so there's been a number of companies that certainly have commercialized their technology, and some of them include Hyzotron, which is based in Eden Prairie. They've gone from seed to actually being merged now with a very large multi-billion-dollar firm. Surmodics is in, I believe, in Eden Prairie as well, and they've gone from the seed stage to the IPO stage many years ago, and certainly they're doing very well. Non-Volatile Electronics Corporation was another company that went from the seed stage to the IPO. And I think their market capitalization is somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million this year. Sage Electrochromics, which is based in Faribault, they went from the seed stage to a merger. And then we have Bemagen, which is a University of Minnesota spinoff, which has also raised capital through investors. So I do not have an actual dollar amount of how much has been raised through outside investors since 1982, but I can say for some of these companies that have gone through the IPO stage, they have raised capital through angel and through venture capitalists to support their commercialization. you know, our one of our goals here with some of the funding is to put together a commercialization report so we can really truly show the products and services that have come out of the SBIR and SDTR programs since 1982 here in Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney?
You know, I was very tempted to ask a 30-year veteran about heel spurs, but I'm not going to. Representative Albright, one of the things that's got me upset about this bill is you never asked me to sign on to it, because it's a bill that either Representative Norton or myself carried about 7 or 8 years ago. I support the SBIR and the STTR piece, and this is actually something that we should have been doing for the last decade. I think this is a great idea. The dollar figure is not the issue for me, although I had the same question Representative Sundin had about targets. One of my concerns with all the money that the state is putting into research and development, angel investment, seed capital, and all the others, is that when an angel investor puts money in, they get a piece of the company. When a investor comes along in the valley of death stage and invests in a company, they get a piece of the company. And we never do. We never, never do, which is a frustration for me, and I think at some point seeing how the investment community has passed all the risk down to the states at this point. And they're getting, you know, rich people don't get rich by spending their money. They get rich by spending other people's money. Have you ever considered, either to the testifier or to Representative Albright, trying to put some kind of a clawback or a warrant or a option to get part of their patent or research or whatever they commercialize? Have you ever done that? Have you ever given that any consideration?
Representative Albright.
Representative Mahoney, I will have a sign-on sheet to you this moment that I hit the chamber floor.
Thank you.
That's my oversight, and I apologize. To your point about the clawback, I think there are a number of ways in which the state benefits by encouraging business development in the state, not the least of which is by the increase in the number of employees that would be supportive of those organizations. And so you have an increase in the number of people that want to come into the state. And I think the peripheral, collateral benefits to that are manifold, and we could spend hours talking about those. But the one primary increase that you find from businesses who site themselves here and expand is the increase in the revenue base from a taxing perspective. Now, I'm all for encouraging businesses to site themselves here and to grow themselves here, and if they need some seed capital that is matched by an outside entity to get themselves started or get them over the hump towards commercialization, I think that benefits the state in ways that might not always be perceived to the naked eye. I'm hesitant to suggest that we want a clawback in there only for the sake that, yes, while on surface it makes sense to have an ownership perspective, but then it also encumbers that organization with the bureaucracy that the government would place upon it. And so I think that we do better by encouraging the matching grants and enable companies to come here, commercialize, and then watch them grow and generate the collateral benefits for other organizations that would come alongside them as well. So, but I appreciate your comments.
Representative Mahoney.
Just a quick comment. There are ways of doing it. We need to start looking at that at a nationwide level. Our tax credits and tax breaks and monies that we pour into small companies that are just starting up at a national level by states is now starting, is approaching almost obscene. And we as taxpayers, we as representatives of taxpayers, certainly we benefit from the jobs created in the states. But there are even more ways that we can benefit And I'll certainly talk to you offline about that because, frankly, just off the top of my head, I know that we are probably at about $75 million a year that we as a state invest in small and mid-sized companies, whether through tax cuts, tax breaks, not tax cuts, but tax credits, tax subsidies, and actual just dollar subsidies, or if this one passes, it adds another $16 million over a biennium. And when if we were investing anywhere else $100 million a year, we would want an ROI of some substance that we could actually track and see. But I think your bill is a good idea. I'm going to support it, and I hope we can find the money, although the hottest rumor doesn't say we're going to have much money to do this.
Representative Wagenius and then O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, to Representative Mahoney's question about clawback, I wouldn't use that word, but we do have a state model, and that is the lottery dollars, LCCMR. If money is granted to a researcher and there's a patent, then by statute, the state gets a portion of the money. So there is a model already out there, and it's been there for years. Only recently has LCCMR been using its money for research, but that statute has been in the books, I think, for a long time. So there is a model.
Representative Albright.
We'll certainly take that under advisement, and thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have some technical things about the language of the bill. I don't see where the funds are coming from, if they're general funds or if they're workforce development funds. It doesn't specify where the funds come from. It doesn't specify tails, if this is going to be continuation. It doesn't have a cap on the administration or the department, so they could technically take all of the money if they wanted to. They're not going to, but you might want to put a cap on that. And if you have an intention on any of those things. And then the last thing, there's no reporting back to the agency. And I know that we at least would be very curious as to see what was the net effect of this. And so if you could maybe just on the record state what your intent was, because it's not in the language for those four pieces.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all good points, sir, Representative. And we will undertake that. I think some of that happens in the bill that's just upcoming in 1951, albeit under a different program, but we'll certainly include those thoughts. My understanding is this is coming through the appropriation to D.
Representative O'Neill.
Right, I understand where it's going to, but where is it coming from? Is it the general fund? Is it the workforce development fund or some other fund we don't know of? The bill language should specify where it's coming from. If it has tails, again, like I said, the cap on the administration from the agency and a report back.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, there are no tails. It's just a fixed amount for 2018 and 2019, and the money is coming from the general fund.
Seeing no additional comments, Representative Albright, you get the last word.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the conversation, and I would urge everyone to support the bill. It is coming to you with bipartisan support. I want to thank those that have authored it so far and those to author it in the very near future. And by way of just encouragement, one of my favorite presidents, Reagan, was actually the first president that wrote the SBIR into law back in 1982. So that's got it's going for it. So with that, thank you.
With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 1950 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Albright. And then next on the agenda is House Chair moves House File 1951 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Albright to House File 1951.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, House File 1951 provides funding to the state's recipient of funding from the Federal Small Business Administration Federal and State Technology or FAST Partnership Program to strengthen the technological competitiveness of small businesses. I will not belabor the point. I understand you have a full agenda. It does improve the participation of small technology firms in the innovation and commercialization of new technology. All 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, Guam, and the American Samoa may receive funding for an array of services from this type of program. We are not to be excluded from that. Governor Dayton designated the Minnesota High Tech Association as the state's designated office for SBIR and STTR assistance. What the fund does is just set that up to host the organization and do some reporting. I have Mr. Dukic with to explain the rest of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association, and I can let our director of the Minnesota SBIR program, Pat Dillon, talk a little bit about what the funds would do and what she does in her role as the director.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so I am the director of MNSBIR, and so I'm going to talk very briefly about the role that I play. So I work with our firms here in Minnesota to compete and win this federal funding to support their research and development efforts. This is a highly complex, competitive program, and many of our small businesses, if they've not come out of Mayo Clinic or they've not come out of the University of Minnesota, navigating the federal process to compete and win these funds is very challenging for them. So I like to think that, you know, I'm the educator, I'm the navigator, the translator, and in some cases, some clients call me the therapist because it is really competitive, and when they're not successful in winning their funds, they can't move forward with their project. So I'm there to help guide and advise them through this very competitive program to help identify those federal agencies that have an interest in the research that they're proposing to do. And then to help them through that process of getting their proposal drafted and submitted to that federal agency for consideration. Now, it's not only just in the phase one phase that I work with them, but it's also getting them from the phase one to the phase two, where the larger dollar amounts are available. But the whole goal at the end of the day is to really support technology commercialization, to turn those ideas, those concepts into products and services that can be sold either nationally or internationally. The whole goal is to really help support those entrepreneurs to be growing businesses here in Minnesota. And that can take on many different forms. And I've been doing this since 1994. And I've seen a lot of changes occur within the SBIR program. And we help translate those changes into those firms that are, you know, pursuing funding, and then those that are in the future that are planning to go after this funding to support what they're doing. I will add that for some of the projects that I work on, and they're really, really complex and highly scientific, they're risky, technically very risky. There's no other way that those ideas could ever get off the ground if it were not for the SBIR funding, but then also the help that I provide along with some consultants that I have with me on an ad hoc basis to help them be successful.
Thank you. Representative Albright, did you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to note that the funding here would go to support the work that Ms. Dillon does through Minnesota SBIR and to support the work that we heard about in House File 1950. The state designee gets federal funding to support some of the cost of operating the state SBIR program, but it doesn't cover everything, so this bill would help bridge that gap in funding for the host organization.
All right, thank you. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing that there is none, we'll close public testimony. We'll move to member questions. Any member questions here? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long have we been getting these FAST funds, or have we not?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen. So over the years, the FAST has been around since about 2000. In Minnesota, we had another organization that provided this assistance, and we were successful in getting, I think, 1 or 2 years worth of this FAST funding. And then after that, the program transitioned into the state of Minnesota, and I think they had 1 year of funding. So this is, I've personally been involved on seven of these FAST awards, not only here in Minnesota, but in Wisconsin as well. So now I'm back here doing my thing that I absolutely love, and this FAST funding is critical to support this office.
Representative Thiessen, follow-up?
Yes. So have we gotten this money before, and how long? That's
Representative Albright or the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, yes, we have gotten the funding before. 2 years, one or two years while I was at Minnesota Project Innovation back in the late early 2000.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. I mean the High Tech Association, since you've been the designee.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, back from 1984 until 2004, there was an organization called Minnesota Project Innovation that was the designee of SBIR and SDTR assistance. And in 2003, we were not funded by the state, so the program then transitioned into the state of Minnesota.
Representative Thiessen, follow-up.
Okay. So I guess my question is, can you answer that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. MHTA was designated as the host in October of 2016, so October is when MHTA first received funding, and that's the only year thus far that we have received funding for program year, I guess, would be 2017.
Okay. Representative Thiessen, further questions?
No, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I'll add that prior to MHTA, we had 1 year of FAST funding, or 2 years of FAST funding with the Minnesota, or MEDA, Metropolitan Economic Development Association.
Thank you. Any further member questions? Seeing none, the chair will renew lay this bill over for possible inclusion in a later bill. With that, Representative Albright, you give you the final word, I guess.
Just fair said it all, Mr. Chair.
We're good. All right, thank you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, this bill's laid over. Next bill will be is Representative David's in the House. Not seeing him. Representative Wagenius, are you ready?
We can do that.
I'm okay.
So you were in Washington.
It'll come right.
Don't chat.
Representative Wagenius, thank you for presenting this bill. Would you like to move House File 1923?
I would like to move it and I assume send it to taxes.
Representative Wagenius moves that House File 1923 will be heard and upon passage be moved to the Tax Committee. Representative Wagenius, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
House File 1923 provides a tax credit for co-ops and muni customers who install solar. This bill is very closely modeled after Iowa's solar energy tax law that is in effect right now. And one of the things I am sending around to you is the brochure from the Iowa Department of Revenue. Specifically, what House File 1923 does, it provides a tax credit as a percentage of the cost for a solar energy system according to when the system is installed. The maximum credit is $5,000 for a homestead and $20,000 for a business. And the operative language in this bill starts on line 2.5. It says after December 16th and before December 2016 and before January 2020, there's a 15% credit. After December 2019 and before January 2021, there's a 13% credit. And after December 2020 and before January 2023, there's an 11% credit. This is exactly what Iowa has in its law. In this case, the credit exceeds the tax due. It can be carried over for up to 10 years. A taxpayer may apply separately for a homestead and each business that that taxpayer has. The bill provides a maximum of $5 million each year in tax credits, split evenly between homesteads and businesses. If claims are not used for one, then they can be allocated to the other. That's the basic bill, and I would be glad to take questions before we have any testifiers, or there are some testifiers here.
Representative Wagenius, let's bring your testifiers down and get their input on this. Are there any here at this time? Welcome to the committee. Have a seat, and please state your name for the record.
Here, you can sit here if you want. Hi, thank you for having us. Thanks. My name is Elizabeth Lucenti. I'm a policy associate with MNSEA, which is the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We are very happy to have this opportunity to come and testify for Representative Wagenius in support of this bill. And thank you for having us. I'll keep my comments brief. I know you have a packed committee schedule today. I want to focus mainly on one of our members, Novel Energy Solutions, who is here today. This is Cliff Kaler. He'll introduce himself. But we have about 104 members currently in MNSEA. We're a trade association and represent most of the industry in the state of Minnesota. We have developers, manufacturers, contractors, and some policy organizations as well. And we are very happy to report that we support this bill fully. We see that Minnesota has no current solar tax credit, and we would like to align ourselves with the Iowa movement and provide a rounded-out incentive program to increase the business opportunities for solar and renewable development in this state. And this is a great way to do it. One thing that our members do come to us and say is that as business owners, they have to sell product. And if a customer is saying, why solar? Why would I do this right now? There has to be a now element to have a good sale and to increase business. And one way to do that is to have a good incentive like a tax credit. And you say, this tax credit isn't going to be around forever. Let's do it now. Let's make it happen now, and let's increase the renewable portfolio in the state. With that, I will hand the mic over to our member, unless there are any questions.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Cliff Kaler. I'm the CEO of Novel Energy Solutions. I don't think it'll come as a surprise, being an energy management company, that we are pro this bill. But, you know, what I want to touch on is the reason why we like this bill. You know, I'm not going to come up and testify on something that doesn't make sense, even if it hurts my industry. You know, MNSEA can talk to that. There's other solar programs that we're not huge fans of and that we haven't necessarily testified positive for. The reason I like this is it, you know, being from a fifth-generation family farm, this is focused on the rural areas. A lot of our other, not even just solar, a lot of our other programs are focused on the urban areas. You know, the customers that this applies to right now aren't eligible for the Made in Minnesota program. And so this is hitting a subset of customers that are in the rural areas that currently aren't eligible for the other incentives that, you know, the more urban investor-owned utility customers are eligible for. You know, the other main benefit is this is going to help create jobs in the rural areas. You know, for our company, you know, we've grown to about 30 people. It's all of our businesses word of mouth. But I will say there is a slight price increase when we have systems in western Minnesota. You know, like say, with our business being word of mouth, you know, we kind of go where the customers are. But, you know, in these rural areas, this helps offset some of that because, you know, rather than a 30-minute or an hour drive time from site to site, you have 2, 3, and 4-hour drive times, which, you know, any business owner can tell you that's going to increase costs. And finally, you know, someone who is a big believer in smart solar versus you know, other solar, I'll call it, I think this program is a really good chance to see the comparison of how a credit like this works versus some of the other incentives that are around. And I think, you know, what I like about this is it doesn't pick winners and losers in the solar industry. It's just set up for, you know, kind of it promotes the market finding what is the best solution as opposed to, you know, using a specific panel or a specific installer and getting a different price. But again, my support for it boils down to, one, I think it's the smartest way to have the biggest impact on volume in the solar industry. You know, solar costs are coming down in for us in a lot of the areas. You know, it's growing, and so we might as well have the industry be centered here rather than have people from out of state come here and, you know, create the solar jobs and have that money leave the state when you have out-of-state companies, and it helps the rural areas. So, like I say, I'm in favor of this bill, and, you know, I think it's one of the smarter legislations. I really like how this is structured of a market-based response, you know, letting the market pick what are the most efficient installers and manufacturers.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan Gleckner. My name is Alan Gleckner. I'm the Director of Energy Markets at Fresh Energy, an independent energy nonprofit that provides in-depth research and analysis of energy policy issues across Minnesota. I'm here today to testify in support of this bipartisan legislation, House File 1923. Minnesota's solar industry has been steadily growing over the last several years, and this bill would help focus further growth and investment specifically in rural communities across greater Minnesota. Over the past several years, thanks to market demand and advances in technology, the cost of solar has been cut dramatically. The $5 million in state funds allocated by this bill in the first year would help unlock more than $30 million in private investment by rural property and business owners. Those investments, in turn, would help support and grow the hundreds of solar businesses and thousands of good-paying solar jobs that we already have across the state and focus those in greater Minnesota. For residential systems, the language in this bill is designed to encourage systems right around the industry average for those homes, and these systems would be aimed to match closely to the needs of those households. For businesses, this bill will encourage investments that help them lock in their energy costs and hedge against future fuel price increases. As Minnesota's solar market grows, we think it's critical that families, schools, businesses, and utilities have different options on the table. Along with community and utility solar investments, the distributed solar encouraged in this bill can play an important role in making Minnesota's electric system resilient and energy independent. So I would urge you to support this bipartisan effort. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Wagenius, did you have any other testifiers? This is a public hearing. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony portion and open to member questions. Any member questions? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question, I've got two questions. One goes to, do I have to have a company install this, or can I do this on my own, and once I get my utility company saying I'm up and I'm generating electricity, can I get the tax credit?
Representative Guinness.
If it's not written that way, I would hope to rewrite it that way. I think that would be fair. But you would have to have the expertise to do it.
Representative Howe.
Thank you. I would assume that I can get that expertise hired by electricians and that and whatnot. But the other question I have then is, if I see there's a difference between a company and if I'm in a limited liability company, that flows back to the individual, the credit does. And so if I do this on my own homestead and then I'm part of a limited liability that has numerous business locations, am I limited to the amount of tax credit I can receive by the number of locations I put out there, or am I limited to 5,000? How does that work if I want to put it on my homestead and then on my numerous business places that I've got different limited liability companies on every different location?
Representative Wagenius.
I think if you look at line 3.4, that will answer your question. You can, as a resident, now apply separately to receive a credit for solar systems installed on a taxpayer's homestead and on business property owned by the taxpayer. And then you can look at lines 2.22, and that talks about the credits
granted to a partnership and all those other things you were talking about.
Representative Howell, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, so is there a limit to what I can get, or am I limited to $5,000, or can I get, I see there's a limit to $20,000. I guess how much of that can flow through to the different partners?
Representative Guinness.
Okay, it's a limit of $5,000 per household, and then a separate limit for a business that's $20,000. And so that $20,000 would be divvied up if it were on some of the other things you were mentioning. So, no, it's not limited to $5,000. You can do it for each business, and but it's a first comes, first serve. Iowa is fully subscribed. So that's I'm not going to say that this is a ton of money for the possible demand out there.
Members, we have some input from research here. Mr. Eloff, would you like to weigh in on this?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out lines 3.6 and 3.7 also say that the taxpayer can apply separately to receive the credit on multiple business properties owned by the taxpayer. And also to Representative Powell's point, paragraph F on lines 222 to 227 say that the credits granted to a limited liability company are passed through to the partners according to their share of the assets of that entity.
Representative Powell, follow up?
No.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilgenius, some earlier solar grant programs that we had, as I recall, they favored the solar voltaic over solar thermal. Does this program treat them those two the same in terms of eligibility in the grant amounts?
Representative Wilgenius.
Yes.
Follow-up, Representative Anderson?
Yeah, then one more question. In our bill summary, it talks about the eligibility is restricted to those who work with a co-op whose net metering program is regulated by the PUC. Could you explain how the PUC regulates a co-op's net metering program? Or is that going to be changing or possibly changing?
Well, Representative Wilkins.
That may possibly change, and if that language comes out, it's okay. It's what I was trying to get at is the reasonable and the additional charge by a utility for net metering must be reasonable and appropriate, and we found that a couple were not in that. So I would assume that that language could come out if we needed to.
Representative Anderson, further member questions? Seeing none, Representative Wagenius, you get the last word on this.
Well, I would appreciate your support and appreciate your sending it to taxes.
And with that, Representative Wagenius renews her motion to send House File 1923 to taxes. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries. You're on your way to taxes. Representative Davids, are you good? Speaking of taxes. Representative Davids, are we looking at 1497 first?
Whatever you prefer. Yeah, that's what that'd be best.
Yeah, 1497. Yep. Let's work on that one here first. We're going to be laying this over. Okay. The chair moves House File 1497 to be laid over possible later bill. We do have an amendment. And the chair will move amendment, the A1 amendment, to get the bill in the shape that the author intends. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment indicate by saying aye.
I don't see it.
Could the pages that handed that out?
Yep.
Okay. All right. I'll do that again. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion has been passed. Representative Davids, to your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill, 1497, establishes a new clean energy rebate program in statute at the Department of Commerce. It provides rebates to individuals and businesses ranging from $2,500 to $25,000 for a variety of wind, solar, geothermal, and energy storage systems. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have to, in full disclosure, I have a company, not that I own, well, I own companies, but not this one, that in my legislative district that actually manufactures some of the parts for what we'll be talking about today. So it certainly piqued my interest. I have no ownership in the company whatsoever, just to make that clear for the record. Just this is good government all the time, Mr. Chairman. So that being said, I'd like to introduce Ms. Sarah Erickson for a few comments, and we have the newly elected president of the Minnesota Farmers Union with us to testify.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, Chairman and committee members. My name is Sarah Erickson. We're really excited today that Representative Davids is carrying House File 1497. I'm here on behalf of DWEA, which is the Distributed Wind Energy Association, and it's a collaborative group comprised of manufacturers, distributors, project developers, dealers, installers, and advocates whose primary mission is to promote and foster all aspects of American distributed wind. Energy costs continue to be an issue for our small businesses, homeowners, and farmers. House File 1497 would create a rebate program for distributed generation. These systems typically use energy sources, including small hydro, biomass, solar power, wind power, and geothermal power, and are increasingly playing an important role for the electric power distribution system. The bill would reduce the cost of investment to accelerate the payback and enable diversification of farm and small business income. Farmers want a way to reduce their operating costs and hedge against the volatility in commodity prices, including the rising cost of electricity. House File 1497 would direct the Department of Commerce to establish a program to provide rebates to individuals who own energy storage systems, wind energy conversion systems, geothermal pumps, or solar thermal systems installed at the residential, farm, commercial, and industrial properties in Minnesota. In 2013, 91% of the small wind systems installed in America were built in America. Like Representative David said, this small widget was built at a manufacturing plant called Strongwell in Chatsfield, Minnesota. And it is part of what will become a larger turbine, hopefully to be placed in the state of Minnesota. We also have manufacturing plants in Duluth and Prior Lake. And with that, we're excited to support a bill that can diversify our rural energy systems as well as help manufacturers in the state of Minnesota. And I'll stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's move to the next testifier here, sir. Again, welcome to the committee, and would you state your name one more time here?
Mr. Chairman, members, Gary Wordish, the newly elected president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. The Minnesota Farmers Union, our members have supported policy like this for a long time. And basically, it's renewable energy incentives help create help get projects going on the farm or out in the rural communities. And in full disclosure, according like Representative Davids, I do have recently installed solar system on my farm, and I also have a geothermal system that I installed a few years back. The talk about the geothermal, my wife and I, we had an old house and an old coal burner that was converted into a fuel oil. And that was our heating system, and every year, something would go wrong, and the person that would service it kept telling us, well, you got to replace that. You know, pretty soon I won't be able to find parts for it. That was in the geothermal with the federal energy tax credit. We had looked at it for a number of years, but we couldn't afford it. But once that became available, we put that in. The recently installed solar, we're committed, you know, someday I hope to have a family member living on my farm, and we all know that energy costs are going to continually go up. That's just a matter of, you know, that's just going to happen. So just installed recently a solar one to hopefully lower our energy costs. Rebates work. We've got a local energy co-op. They all offer rebates on just whether you just buy a new refrigerator or freezers, air conditioners, they work. We bought a new refrigerator a few years back when they came out with that, so a rebate program does work. We feel very strong in this bill would help jumpstart that industry.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Representative Davids, did you have any other testifiers?
No, I don't.
This is a public hearing. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. Are you here to testify? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bill Black with Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. Just to bring up a concern with the legislation that may not need to get fixed here, but something that we'd like to place on the table, is that there's a provision on page 2, lines 15 through 17, that allow for third-party ownership of facilities on a utility customer's property. And that's all fine, and we applaud the legislation for, you know, providing from state funds rather than utility collected funds for this type of a rebate. However, that provision seems to allow a third party to own the facilities on a customer's property. And we would just like to clarify, perhaps with language that says the sale of electricity is the exclusive right of the utility serving the service area. So while a third party may own the property, they may not sell the output in terms of electricity to that customer. So I have suggested language, but it hasn't really been looked at. And if you'd like us, we can try to take care of that here or later when the author has time to look at it.
Mr. Black, thank you for your testimony. We have some input here to the testifier.
Committee Chair, Sarah Erickson with UWIA. Bill, or Mr. Black, excuse me, just brought this language to my attention. We're happy to continue to work with him, and I think this omnibus bill won't be put together for a couple of weeks, so we'd be happy to sit down and work with that.
Thank you for your input. Mr. Black, I think what we will do, since we had a deadline requirement here, I'm going to encourage you to work offline with the interested parties, and as it comes forward on the omnibus bill, let's look for a potential amendment. So.
Thank you.
Any other public testimony? With that, I will close the public testimony period and open to member questions. Members, any questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for the author. Would a sheet music historical center be eligible for something like this?
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Mahoney, if it's not, it will be.
Representative Mahoney, follow-up.
Actually, I do have a serious question.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. You have appropriations for 2 years. You know, my only concern with a lot of these things is how long they last. I take it you are really only doing this for 2 years. Is your intent to make this much longer than 2 years, or reevaluated after 2 years, or have solar and wind and all the other industries on their own after 2 years?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, in the bill it is limited, and we'd like to see how it works. And if it works, wonderful. If not, well, at least we gave it a shot.
Representative Mahoney. Any further member questions? Seeing none, the chair will lay over a House file 1497 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Moving on, members, to our next bill. Looks like our final one here for the day would be House File 1985. Representative Davids, were there any amendments to this bill?
Not that I'm aware of.
With that, the chair will move that House File 1985 upon passage be sent to the Tax Committee. Representative Davids, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has a history not so much in the House, but in that other body that we can't talk about. This was in the tax bill last year from the other body, and it was moved forward, and it was kind of like a whole lot of things the way it looked to me that we hadn't even talked about in the House. So we put the brakes on, put a stop to it, and said let's work on it and see if we can run through the process so the committees will have the opportunity to hear what's going on here. This bill simply establishes a valuation of utility personal property. And in the past, this bill has actually been around in the past. It was not in House File 848, even before the conference report. I believe that's correct, right? That was not in, yeah. But generally when these things have come forward, they've gone straight to tax committee. So we're here because we want to make sure we vet anything that has to do with this committee here, obviously. So with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Rick Evans to give a brief synopsis of the bill, and then we'd stand for questions. And I don't know if there's another testifier, too, I believe. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. As I'm sure most of the members of the committee know, the utilities are
somewhat unique in the state of Minnesota in that in addition to real property tax, we pay personal property tax. And, in fact, the personal property tax is significantly more dollars each year than the personal property tax. It's one of the reasons that Xcel Energy is the highest property taxpayer in the state. One of the peculiarities of a personal property tax is that it is somewhat unstable and unpredictable. As companies make investments, usually very large investments in plants, the value of the plant goes up and the tax revenues go up. But these are depreciating assets, and so as the assets begin to depreciate, the tax revenue goes down. And over the last many years, we have struggled back and forth with the communities that host our largest assets as they watch their revenues go up and down in this somewhat unusual way when compared to, say, the relative stability of a real property tax. And so this bill is really an attempt to try to break this investment depreciation cycle and put taxes on a more stable and predictable and more easily administered method. Essentially what it does is instead of establishing valuation based on the value of the assets, it establishes valuation based on the capacity and the energy production of each of the facilities. And this would create a more stable revenue generation for the local governments that receive this money. In addition, we have over the years created something of a patchwork of generation sites that are exempt from this tax and others that are covered by this tax, and that's created some frustration and some evenness across the system. And so that's also attempted to be addressed in this bill by allowing people to keep the tax exemptions that they currently have during their current contract, but having those expire at the end of those contracts so that over time we would have a more uniform system across the state. As you can imagine, this is a very complicated discussion between all of the various utilities, all the people that own production assets, and all of the local government units that receive this money. And so it's taken quite a lot of work to get to this point where we think we are approaching something like revenue neutrality. Some communities are going to lose money and some communities are going to gain money based on this reworking of the formulation. And so there's transition aid proposed to ease that transition for those communities. Of course, once we get into the tax committee, we start applying numbers to this. Some of these things are going to have to move. But in terms of the impact on energy policy, I'm not altogether certain what questions the committee may have. But from the utility's point of view, this is designed to be revenue neutral, so we're not paying any more or any less tax than we've paid in the past. But we're trying to stabilize it as we go forward.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have another testifier here, Carolyn Jackson. Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Good morning. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm an attorney lobbyist with the firm Flaherty & Hood, and I'm here representing the Coalition of Utility Cities. The Coalition of Utility Cities is a group of seven cities that host investor-owned utilities. The cities are Hoyt Lakes, Cohasset, Becker, Monticello, Granite Falls, Oak Park Heights, and Red Wing. We'd like to thank Representative Daniels for carrying House File 1985.
David,
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm breathing. I should just think. thank you, Representative Davids, for carrying 1985. It has the potential to lend revenue stability, as Mr. Evans said, to both communities and utilities. The current tax on electric generation equipment is a significant source of revenue for our communities. Since this was introduced in the other body, we've been working with the stakeholders on reaching a mutually acceptable bill, and we look forward to working with Representative Davids and the other stakeholders as we move forward in the tax committee. And we just want to thank you for hearing this bill today.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other testifiers, Representative Davids?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. This is the public hearing. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing that there are none, we will close the public testimony period and open to member questions. I do have one right off the bat. Representative Davids, if
If you wanted to bring Carolyn or Rick down, that'd be fine. But I've been tracking this bill now for 5 years. I've been watching it as it has moved forward. And for the committee's sake, this is in deep in the weeds tax issues. Currently, right now, our tax situation, the way that we set up the tax formula for power plants, is quite complex and involved. Upon passage of this bill, if we are able to implement this new tax system, it will greatly simplify the tax, the way that the taxes are calculated for power plants. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, absolutely. I think I shouldn't speak for the Department of Revenue, but I think that, you know, we've been working closely with them on this bill, and I believe they would find this, and certainly the people, the tax people within Xcel Energy, maybe I'll speak for them instead of the Department of Revenue, find this believe this will be a much easier and more predictable and more stable way to calculate taxes and predict them going forward as we plan our business and as communities plan their revenue.
Thank you for your answer, Mr. Evans, and that is the reply that I have been getting consistently from folks in the industry and then also from the folks in the cities, the coalition utility cities. So with that, I'll move on to any member questions. Any member questions? Representative Mahoney, I had you up here first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Davids. When do you expect to know who will be the winners and the losers here? Your testifiers have kind of alluded to the fact that once this is recalibrated, that there will be winners and losers, and the property tax will be figured entirely different.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, as you know, in tax committee, we only have winners. And so that being said, there will be a list because it does change things. There will be some that receive a little more, some receive a little less. And that's the provisions we're looking at for the transition aid because of this. I don't want any cities to be losers, if you will. Everybody has to at least break even or win. That's the approach I'm taking here. And the theory is that over a period of time through the transition aid, then we will get to a spot where there really shouldn't be winners and losers because it should be implemented so that everybody's on the same level playing field. And we're taking away the peaks and the valleys, which can really hurt some of these communities. And a lot of these communities are not high population communities. So that's the theory behind it. We will crunch the numbers in tax committee, and we'll also hear more. We are always very open to the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, this has to work for, in my mind, for three entities. It has to work for the Department of Revenue, it has to work for the affected cities, and it has to work for the utilities. Otherwise, as far as I'm concerned, we don't go forward.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Follow-up, Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not a follow-up. It's just I appreciate what Chair Davids said, because, you know, St. Paul, and I don't know about Minneapolis, but I think it has probably the same number of Xcel Energy facilities in its city that we do, or creates the same amount of tax, or proportionately the same amount of tax. This has not been a good year for the metro area cities, and I hopefully this is not one more hit against the metro area cities, and we don't end up footing the bill for the whole thing at the end of the day, because that certainly is our cities are struggling to keep property taxes in line, and every time we get charged something and other places don't, or we end up paying for something because it comes out of, well, Xcel pays for everything across the state energy-wise, and most of their customer service base is in the Twin City area. I just don't want to have another hit to our city's ability to provide services like libraries and police and street repair. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your assurances that you won't hit the metro area cities any harder than they. Well, I'll leave it at that.
Representative O'Neill.
I think Representative Davis.
Representative Davids, did you want to follow up to that?
Well, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Mahoney's points are very, very well taken, and I do not see from this bill, I mean, everybody's affected, but I don't see where the cities of the first class would be negatively affected.
You haven't been in this committee.
Well, I do LGA.
Representative Mahoney, are you good? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and I both have these plants actually in our districts, and so we're the cities that they're talking about. I think they listed the test fair listed the six or seven cities, and it's Monticello and Becker and a few others, but they didn't list off the Twin Cities. It's the ones that actually have production plants. So unless you have a nuclear power plant in Minneapolis or St. Paul, I don't think it's directly affected. But let me continue on with something else. So what they were talking about is the money that we receive from Xcel Energy, and it's similar to a property tax, but it's a tax on, you know, the equipment and things like that, because we have the Monticello nuclear power plant in my district, and he has Sherco in his district. But I wanted to ask a question about the transition aid. So I know that I've been watching this bill for at least 3 years. I don't think I've watched it for 5 years like you have, but for three. And do you have a sense as to how much transition aid in total it would cost in order to make the cities whole so that they're not seeing huge drops? I know that was a contention in the other body and trying to figure out how to make everyone whole. So it's net neutral for Xcel Energy. You're not paying any more or any less in tax, and so the ratepayer wouldn't pay any more or any less. So that's why I say I don't think Minneapolis or St. Paul would be affected. But as far as the cities receiving this tax, this revenue, the total aid.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, to Representative O'Neill. Excuse me, that's what we'll be talking about in tax committee, and I don't have those numbers. I don't believe there's a fiscal note yet or a revenue note or anything that I've seen. No. So I don't know.
Okay. All right, Representative O'Neill, follow-up?
No, I was just really curious because I know I've been watching that number bounce around for the last 3 years anyway, and it would have been nice to just kind of see what kind of ballpark number it's going to take to make sure everyone is held harmless and we don't have huge problems in each of these six or seven cities.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is a question for Ms. Jackson or who, but Cohasset is in my district and greatly impacted in part of these discussions. I'm really pleased to see this go forward. Itasca County area has a lot of public land, very little tax base. Three key taxpayers are the paper company, the utilities, pipelines. That's it. And all of those taxes are being challenged. And so it really does take a hit on those little communities. Cohasset at one time, I think, was 33% dependent on its utility. So my question is, it appears that the backfilling from the general fund might phase out over time. Is that true?
Representative Davis or Ms. Jackson?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, there are two things with the replacement aid. One is that, yes, it goes down by 5% annually, so it isn't forever. I don't know whether Cohasset would qualify even for the transition aid. They might be held harmless under this bill. But if they were to get it, it would go down a little bit. But also there is a factor in this bill that increases the value over time. So while the transition aid is going down, the valuation is going up. And that's one of the things that we're insisting upon, is to make sure that those go up over time, because the expenses of the city also go up over time. So both the replacement aid and the adjustment factor are things that we will insist upon in negotiations. There's something else, and this will affect Cohasset as well. In the replacement aid, there's a click-on factor. So if there's a major change to the tax base, I believe it's like a 10% trigger or something like that, if a plant were to close, the replacement aid would click on. So it's not just a one-time thing. It would make sure that the city is held whole if there was a major change, and then that replacement aid would go down over time. But it does provide our communities with a certain amount of certainty going forward, and also a little bit of protection against these major market changes.
Representative Lehman, follow-up?
Thank you.
Further member questions? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion to pass House File 1985 and move that on to taxes. All in favor of House File 1985, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes.
Members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir.
Members, looking at our agenda, it looks like we finished. And with that, we are adjourned.